Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is once again about Russia's war against Ukraine. We'll be talking about the situation on the battlefield and also the diplomacy, including what seems like a new wave of talk about talks. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Ruth Deyermond, senior lecturer in the Department of War Studies at King's College London and a specialist on Russian foreign and security policy, U.S.-Russian relations, and European security. Thanks very much for joining me, Ruth.
Thank you for having me on, Steve.
All right, it's great to have you on the show again. Now, first, let's talk about what's happening on the battlefield. Russian forces captured the city of Vuhledar on October 2nd. It's one of the cities in the Donetsk region that has long since been severely damaged. Russian forces have also taken more territory since they seized Vuhledar, but they have not managed to capture Pokrovsk, which is a much larger city to the north, that is seen as a crucial logistical hub. And as in other cases in the full-scale war, which is headed toward its fourth year this coming February, the capture of Vuhledar came at a heavy price for Russia in terms of casualties and the loss of equipment. Now, while Russia's war against Ukraine is often called the war in Ukraine, another factor in both the fighting and the diplomacy this fall is Ukraine's offensive in the Kursk region of Russia, where Kyiv's forces launched a cross-border attack in early August and remain more than 2 months later, holding a small but significant chunk of Russian territory. This is something that's virtually unprecedented since World War II. Meanwhile, away from the front, Russia continues to target vital infrastructure and hit and kill civilians in cities and towns across Ukraine as winter approaches. Ruth, it's been 2 years and nearly 8 months since Russian President Vladimir Putin launched the large-scale invasion of Ukraine, an attack that he apparently believed would bring the country to its knees within weeks. At this point, where do you think the fighting is headed, and what are some of the crucial things to watch in the coming months? I'm going to mention two possibilities of crucial things, but you can comment as you like. One would be, of course, the U.S. election coming up on November 5th, and another within Ukraine is the struggle to mobilize more men to get to the battlefield, which is having some repercussions in Ukraine. Just wondering if I could get some of your takeaways on where things seem to be headed.
Yeah, I mean, I would say both of those factors are obviously extremely important, and in fact, the issue of the election, which I'll come back to in a second, is in the United States, I think, is probably the most important issue of all. In terms of what's happening on the battlefield, I mean, I suppose one of the notable things, the notable aspects of it, is really that not that much has changed. You know, if we think back to the first year of the war, we saw, you know, very dramatic advances and counter-offensive in the case of Ukraine, you know, very substantial kind of changes in the front lines, the who was holding territory, and that just hasn't happened this year. I think because the nature of the war has changed, because of the way that the war seems to favour defensive positions rather than offensive positions now. Absolutely, we've seen some Russian advances, but these haven't been huge, right? These have been pretty modest advances at enormous cost of men and equipment. Obviously, also, you know, those advances have been limited at enormous cost to the Ukrainian armed forces as well. So, I think in some ways, perhaps what's more significant than the pretty modest advances by the Russian armed forces is the attention that's being paid to those advances. Particularly the attention that's being paid to the Russian advances in the West relative to the quite extraordinary fact that the Ukrainian armed forces have, as you said, been holding Russian territory for 2 months now, which is unprecedented in the post-Second World War period. But the focus has been on what Russia is doing. And I think that tells us something about where Western thinking is, at least in some quarters. You know, this sense that actually, even if Russia can't make major advances, then Ukraine also can't, you know, make major gains in recapturing territory. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is something that you've alluded to already mentioned, which is this very difficult question of manpower. In fact, I think both states seem to be grappling with manpower problems, although it's more obviously acute in the case of Ukraine. But the issue of kind of mobilization in Russia as well as Ukraine is something that's been very difficult, very sensitive for the Russian government as for the Ukrainian government. But I think, as I said, that the really key issue, the perhaps not the single determining factor, but the most significant factor that's going to be driving the outcome of the war, I think, and certainly what happens in the next few months, is the US election in 3 weeks. Because we've known for a very long time that the outcome of the election will determine, in effect, whether Ukraine continues to be supported by the United States, or the extent to which it's supported by the United States. And this is because, while I think we could expect a Harris White House to continue to act in much the same way, perhaps, as the Biden White House, certainly not a dramatic, you know, turn away from Ukraine, Donald Trump has made it very clear that he wants to see an end to the war quickly. And we know that one of his long-term foreign policy priorities, one of the few consistent foreign policy positions he's held since before he was elected in 2016, was, as he puts it, getting along with Russia. So he would want to see the war ended quickly and on Russia's terms, I think. And of course, everyone is acutely aware of that. So I think that's going to be the most significant factor, actually. And I also think it's, as I say, driving a lot of the discussion around where the front lines are at the moment.
All right. Thanks very much for that. Yeah. Interesting to point out the kind of, even more maybe than sort of the facts on the ground, the way the situation on the ground is being treated and described in the West is a very big factor, particularly ahead of this U.S. election. And my second question is actually quite related to that, and you've already made some comments about it, I guess. It's about what I'm calling the diplomacy, though I'm not sure whether that's the greatest way to describe it. And we're speaking, it looks like U.S. President Joe Biden will be traveling to Germany later this week, reportedly on Friday. This is after what had been a planned summit involving Biden and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and European leaders was scrapped. That had been planned for October 12th at the U.S. Base at Ramstein, Germany, but Biden called off his trip to Europe because of the hurricane in the United States. So we may be having, this diplomacy may be heating up again. And of course, Zelensky's been traveling around Europe, also talking about what he calls his victory plan, and seeking support for that after his visit to the U.S. earlier. So I want to focus here on what seems to be the latest round of talk about talks. In other words, discussion among officials, the media, and others about the prospects for negotiations to end the fighting. And you spoke about this. Let me just try to set up the context for my question, and feel free to correct me if I'm getting anything wrong or framing it the wrong way, perhaps. My understanding is that while Russia has been making territorial gains, neither side has a real prospect of winning outright anytime soon. For Ukraine and Zelensky, this suggests, or at least a common view is that Kyiv's goal of regaining all of its territory from an invader that occupies about one-fifth of the country, is out of reach under the current circumstances. Now, here I'm quoting from my own effort to explain the situation in an article last week. This calculation is contributing to increasing pressure on Zelensky to set aside the aim of territorial integrity for the time being and consider seeking an arrangement or settling for an arrangement that would stop the fighting and put security guarantees from the West in place, but would leave chunks of the country in Russian hands, not formally, but physically. Now, since the beginning of this month, there seems to be a lot of talk along these lines and talk about what those security guarantees might be, NATO membership or something else. While at the same time, Russia has given no indication that it's actually ready for talks on anything other than its own terms, which include no NATO membership for Ukraine. In some ways, Moscow seems to have been toughening its rhetoric of late. For example, a recent article in the outlet Pojasnitelnaya Zapiska that cited what it said were high-level sources close to Putin delivered a message, I'd say, with its headline, which I would translate as, "The Kremlin has drawn a conclusion. We will destroy the state of Ukraine." Ruth, what do you make of all this? And what will you be watching to see how things develop on the diplomatic front in the coming weeks and months?
So there's a huge amount to talk about there. I think the first thing to note is, of course, that in some ways we've been here before. I mean, there's a kind of cycle of discussion about the imminence of talks and the need for Ukraine to go to the negotiating table, and it seems to kind of crop up in Western media and the kind of policymaking communities about two or three times a year since the start of the war. So in some ways we've been here before, but I think perhaps things are looking a little different this time, for various reasons, and partly because we're now so long into the war, and there are all these kind of material pressures, manpower pressures, equipment pressures on Ukraine, but also the shadow of the US, imminent US election. So, are the kind of mutterings different this time? Possibly. It's a little hard to say, but yeah, I think it's, it's pretty clear to everyone, whether people acknowledge it or not, that the way that the war has developed since late 2022, early 2023, has really kind of precluded the prospect of Ukraine regaining territorial integrity in this phase of the war. In the absence of a major change to what's happening on the battlefield, or the political collapse of the Russian will to carry on fighting, the Russian government's willingness to carry on fighting. So, in the absence of a significant change, it doesn't look as if Ukraine is going to get control over all of its territory in the near future. And I guess this is one of the things driving talk of some kind of peace settlement. That there are multiple difficulties with this, though, of course, and we may have talked about them before, but as you said, there's really no indication that the Russian government is willing to engage in good faith negotiations any more than it ever has been since the start of the war. But it's also the case, and I think this is not something that's talked about enough in kind of Western policy circles and or Western media, it's also the case that some kind of settlement to stop the fighting, if not actually resolve the war, would, if it were to happen in the current circumstances, really be giving Russia something that the Russian government has always wanted, which is a frozen conflict. Now, frozen conflicts have been one of the key methods by which, or the key implements with which, the Russian government has tried to assert influence or control in the countries around it since the collapse of the Soviet Union. So this is something that it's been doing for over 30 years now. And we've already seen how that's worked out in Ukraine after 2014 with the Minsk agreements. I don't think anybody seriously thinks that any kind of settlement, temporary settlement that ended the fighting would actually resolve the war. And indeed, I mean, there would be a question about whether fighting would continue unofficially, but also whether actually what such an agreement would do would simply be to give the Russian government breathing space to reconstitute some of its forces and start the fighting again at a time of its convenience. But of course, that even if Western governments and Western analysts understand this, ultimately one of the things that that Western support is coming up against is the nature of democratic politics. And we can see this in the US, right? That support for Ukraine is conditional on the outcome of the US elections, not just the presidential election, but also the congressional elections. But we can see the same thing in Europe as well, right? There are pressures in countries like Germany, let alone countries that are no longer democratic, like Hungary. There are pressures to see a resolution to the war or to end the fighting. And certainly for democratic politicians in countries like Germany, that is going to be, I think, perhaps a more urgent issue for them than worrying about whether a ceasefire agreement is just going to set up trouble further down the road. So I'm concerned, I suppose, if there is more substance to the kind of chatter about negotiations, that it's being driven by kind of short-term political interests in the West, and that is not a recipe for peace, ultimately. That's a recipe for a deferred conflict that's going to become worse in the long run.
Absolutely. That's kind of a chilling thought, really. I just ask one follow-up question on this. You mentioned Russia likes frozen conflicts, and short of capturing Ukraine, which it attempted to do, would presumably be quite happy with a frozen conflict in which it controls part of Ukraine, a significant part, and the opportunity to rebuild its forces and potentially go on the attack again. So one question I want to ask is just, a lot of the talk now is about security guarantees for Ukraine, membership of NATO, or something similar. Maybe hard to say, but is this kind of, is there a chance that such a thing could work? And I most hesitate to bring it up because maybe it's advancing this talk about talks. But the idea that, if there's a real security guarantee in place, does that dissuade or deter Russia from using the frozen conflict, if it does become frozen, to kind of regain strength and attack again? Is that possible?
It's a very difficult question to answer because we're really in uncharted territory here, not uncharted in terms of security guarantees, because of course, unfortunately, we've been here before with Ukraine. You know, the West and indeed Russia provided Ukraine with security guarantees in the 90s that were not respected. But I think, you know, the big uncertain factor, one of the big uncertain factors in this, is what the Russian government thinks about Western resolve. You know, whether if Western countries, if the US, other NATO members, if they were willing to offer Ukraine some kind of substantial security guarantee short of NATO, whatever that would be, as part of a kind of deal to end fighting, if they were to do that, would Russia take that seriously? Or would the Russian government regard that simply as the West, as NATO, backing down in the face of Russian threats? And clearly, if Russia gets the sense that the West isn't prepared to fully back its words with action on security for Ukraine, then clearly that wouldn't be a sustainable solution, even a short-term solution. I think it's pretty clear, at least it seems to me, that the Russian government is fairly convinced that Western states are pretty weak, that they're actually pretty coercible. And so, you know, a security guarantee short of NATO membership, I think, wouldn't actually be something that would convince either the Ukrainians or indeed the Russians. You know, we can see Russia boundary testing NATO and NATO's resolve to defend even its own members, you know, all the time. Less so on conventional kind of conflict issues, but certainly in terms of threats to critical infrastructure, attacks on, when we've seen this week, both the Swedish and German governments and security services talking about Russian attacks inside their countries, you know, not military attacks, but, you know, attacks on the transport system, you know, surveillance, you know, and of course, in the past, we've seen attacks on transport systems and other elements of critical infrastructure in the West. So we can see from that, you know, the Russian government really isn't, it seems to me, very frightened of NATO at the moment. And so, again, to come back, any kind of security guarantee short of NATO membership, which is something that Russia is desperate to avoid in the case of Ukraine, I'm not sure how seriously Russia would take it. And that in itself is going to make it an undesirable option for Ukraine.
All right. Thank you, Ruth. It's food for thought, certainly, going into this kind of uncertain period, another uncertain period in the Russia's war against Ukraine. Thanks very much. We're going to wrap it up here. Thanks for joining me, Ruth.
Thank you.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Ruth Deyermond, a senior lecturer in the Department of War Studies at King's College London, and a specialist on Russian foreign and security policy, U.S.-Russia relations, and European security. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.